Hello, and welcome to Dark and Stormy Book Club. Today is our second holiday recast, and we have a visit with Caitlin Rother. It was episode 163. Enjoy.
I'm Ann Dark.
I'm Tracy Stormy.
And I'm Kathy Knight.
And together we are
It Was a Dark and Stormy Book Club,
a podcast for mystery lovers.
Welcome!
If you enjoy our show, please consider contributing to the Dark and Stormy Patreon. By becoming a patron, you will help us create better and quality content. There are also benefits to becoming a patron, such as exclusive content and Dark and Stormy merchandise. Become a supporter at patreon.com/darkandstormybc. Check our website for the link. We appreciate any and all contributions. Thank you.
Death on Ocean Boulevard is the story of the mysterious death of 32-year-old Rebecca Zahow, who was found hanging from a second-story balcony of her multimillionaire boyfriend's mansion in 2011. She was naked and gagged, with her ankles tied and the hands bound behind her. On the door of her bedroom, investigators found a handwritten message. She saved him. Can you save her? The death was deemed a suicide, but Rother reveals there is much more to the story. New York Times best-selling author Caitlin Rother has written or co-authored over 14 books. Rother regularly appears as a TV crime analyst and speaker. She also takes on a limited number of clients as a writing research promotions coach and consultant. Before quitting the news business to write books full-time, Rother worked for 19 years as an investigative reporter for daily newspapers, covering issues ranging from addiction, suicide, mental illness, and murder to politics and corruption at City Hall and in Congress. Rother was a Pulitzer-nominated staff writer for the San Diego Union-Tribune and also has been published in Cosmopolitan, the Los Angeles Times, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, Boston Globe, Daily Beast, and Huffington Post. She earned her bachelor's degree in psychology from the University of California, Berkeley, and her master's in journalism at Northwestern University. Her website is caitlinrother.com.
We would like to welcome Caitlin Rother to the program. She has a fascinating true crime story coming out called The Death on Ocean Boulevard. Welcome, Caitlin.
Hi.
I am a big fan of all true crime, but this case is one of the strangest cases I've ever came across.
Yeah, me too.
And there's been some weird ones out there, but this one truly takes the cake. There are many examples of people acting abnormally under the use of Ambien. Why wasn't Adam's use of the popular sleep aid investigated and questioned more?
That's a good question. I was wondering that too. I had heard before I got into this case that he had taken an Ambien, and I don't know exactly how I learned that, but I think it was somewhere in the media. When we got to trial, they didn't mention it at all. And I thought, well, that's kind of weird. So I went back through the court documents. There's something called an in limine motion. These are the motions that are filed before the trial starts, when the different attorneys on both sides are arguing about what can be presented in court and what can't. And I found that Adam Shackney's attorneys fought against the Zahows bringing that up in court. I think your question is about the investigation, though. I don't know if it was even investigated. Like I said, I don't remember exactly. I think he admitted it to the guy that did his polygraph examination, the lie detector test. I don't remember. It was probably during one of his conversations with detectives the day that he said he found her hanging and cut her down. That was my question, too. And I went and I looked online, and Charlie Sheen, I think, was one of them who set up a whole hotel room, and then he blamed it on Ambien. Roseanne Barr said a bunch of stuff and then got herself in trouble, got herself thrown off the show she was on, and she blamed Ambien. I also found that there had been other court cases where the defense used the Ambien defense as they did stuff while they were, quote unquote, asleep on Ambien and didn't remember it the next day, including murder. So I asked Adam that. He got upset about it when I first asked him and then actually canceled an interview that we had planned over that. So it's clearly a touchy subject. I guess the reason that the defense attorneys did not want that in court, there's so much controversy and bad publicity, essentially. And they said, oh, we don't want to get the jurors confused because, you know, it affects some people that way. It doesn't affect other people that way. I guess they probably also were thinking, well, we don't want to mention it because it doesn't matter whether he was on her or not, because he wasn't in the house and he didn't kill her. So it would not be to their benefit. But I think it helped for the weird stuff he said. Like, the reason I was confused is because I had taken an Ambien, and that's why I said, got a girl in the guest house. You know, he could have used it to his benefit, but I guess the defense attorneys just didn't want to bring it up at all because it could have gone either way. I think that's the best answer for that.
I almost feel that the police were Team Adam. Anything that was brought up seemed to be just pushed aside.
I'm not going to take an opinion on that, but I will say that there are people who believe that he was not really investigated enough at all. And that, you know, they didn't take his phone and look at it. Jonas Jackknife, his brother, who was Rebecca's boyfriend, the owner of the home where she was found, they got his phone records. They got Rebecca's phone records. I don't think they got Adam's phone records, and they didn't even look at his phone to see that he was where he was. And so that's been brought up by outside investigators, not with the sheriff's department, but people who've looked at this case. And I said the same thing, you know, that seemed like a no-brainer to me. If he's there and he's the only one there, and what a weird way to find her dead, why wouldn't they look at his phone? I don't know. That seemed like a hole in the investigation.
Well, also, Adam was polygraphed. They deemed the results inconclusive, but outside experts said it clearly showed deception.
Right.
Why didn't Rebecca's family push for more tests?
Well, Rebecca's family wasn't part of the investigation. They didn't get a say in anything. They complain to this day that the investigators didn't share anything with them. They feel like they shared with Jonah Jackknife information, but not with them. And I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's how they feel. But they didn't know that he had been polygraphed, I'm sure, for years until they filed a lawsuit and got into the discovery. They didn't say anything about it because I'm sure they didn't even know that he had been polygraphed, and they didn't know the details of the test or what was said until once they got into the evidence analysis. Detectives don't share their investigation with anybody because it can compromise the investigation. So they purposely hold information back. So for example, the detectives purposely did not disclose the words that were painted on the door. They said there was a message, but they refused to release what the words actually were. I think the only way that anyone found out about that is because a bunch of TV channels and news organizations got together and filed some kind of court action to unseal the search warrant affidavits. And I think that's how they found out what the words on the door were. I might be wrong about that. I know that initially the detectives did not release that. And the reason they do that is because when they're questioning people of interest or suspects, which they were very careful in this case not to label anybody. I think Adam was a person of interest and that was it. But I don't think they had any quote unquote suspects. And they were very careful about that because that has some kind of ramification if you label somebody that way publicly, right? Because they want to see if people are lying. And so if somebody volunteers information about the scene, but they weren't there or they aren't supposed to know, then the investigators are like, well, how does he know that, right? Maybe he was there, you know, that kind of thing. And that's why they don't share with the family. But the family felt that they should have been asked more questions about Rebecca. And they felt like they should have been included more, at least in terms of trying to get more information about Rebecca's state of mind.
Also, another part that makes this very interesting is a female neighbor heard a scream, help me, from a female. And the police commented that there was no way she could have heard because of her advanced age and how far away it was. Was this ever tested?
Let's go back for a second. This lady was elderly and she lived two doors down. She was listening to the TV. She was interviewed by the police several times, and then she was deposed by the attorney some years later. And her story kept changing. I think what probably happened, she said that there was one female detective, she didn't like the way she talked to her, and she was the one who said, oh, you couldn't have heard that. I don't think the detective gave her a reason why. I don't know about her age or anything. I think it was more about what room she was in and which way it was facing. But I wasn't there, so I don't know exactly what was said. I think she said it was a blonde detective. Except I think the only detective that was a female that was there was a dark-haired detective. I think there were some credibility issues from the sheriff's standpoint, and she seemed a little confused. You know, sometimes people want to help. Their memories change sometimes. The answer to your question is no, it wasn't tested, and I think the reason it wasn't tested is because they felt there was a credibility issue there. I think that they just thought, well, the room's facing towards the street, and the courtyard where Rebecca was supposedly hanging was in the rear. So how could she have heard that? The detective was on the stand and asked that question. And I think he just said that he had suggested doing it, and then it just never got done. It was like there were other priorities. I think it would have been good for them to try it, honestly, just to be thorough, but they didn't.
Yeah, that even if she did have some challenges as far as credibility, that it just would have been nice to know, is it possible?
Right. And they could still do that right now.
Yeah.
I called up the real estate agent. The house was on the market for years. Couldn't sell. Finally sold. I didn't even know it was sold. I luckily found out before I turned in the very last version of the galleys. I was able to fix that. And I wanted to go take a look at the house and go inside and walk around because it was vacant, right? And the real estate agent was like, no, you can't do that. I think they just wanted to remove the taint as much as they can because, you know, the locals were calling it the murder house. Now, who wants to buy the murder house? It's on the market. You know, they just want the story to go away. Then I think someone also said, well, no one actually died in the house, which is true.
Right? I never thought about it that way.
Yeah, the little boy, Max, who fell 2 days before Rebecca was found dead, he actually was unresponsive when the paramedics got there and they brought him back. He wasn't declared dead for another 5 days. He had been down for almost 30 minutes before they were able to bring him back with a second shot of epinephrine and a lot of CPR. There's some debate over whether Rebecca really did CPR or much of it. According to Jonah, she told him that she gave Max a few breaths, which is very different from doing CPR. And when you listen to the 911 tape, her little sister, who I've given a pseudonym in the book because she was so young, was calling 911 and Rebecca was yelling out instructions to her while they were on the phone. So I think it's hard to be calling out instructions for CPR. So it's not really clear how much CPR she was really able to give. Boy, she was crying. She sounded really, really upset.
This case all over is one of the strangest I've ever read, and I have a million questions. Rebecca was living with a rich man, but she was also playing the field with other previous lovers. Any of the other investigators come up with any more suspects?
Well, first of all, she wasn't, to my knowledge, seeing anybody while she was with Jonah. Is that what you meant?
Yeah. Wasn't she in contact with her ex-husband? And
oh, yeah. He was texting her, but I don't think that they were seeing each other. He filed for divorce, and it went through while she was with Jonah. And she did not ever contest anything or file anything, even though she told her family that she was the one who had filed. And she told her ex-boyfriend in previous years that she was just waiting for the paperwork to go through. And in fact, neither one of them had filed. So, you know, there were a lot of stories that she told about the divorce, but she was not seeing anybody, to my knowledge. Her ex-husband was still in love with her and always wanted to be back with her. But what he said was that he finally filed the divorce because she was with Jonah. He knew he couldn't compete with Jonah. He had no money like that. She'd already had another boyfriend in the past who was rich that she left him for. She did see other men while she was married, but as to my knowledge, wasn't seeing anybody while she was with Jonah. And you asked, do I think there are any other suspects? So remember I said earlier that the sheriff's department was very careful not to label anybody a suspect because they're saying it's a suicide. The only person who has been found in court to be considered a suspect is Adam Shacknai. There's no evidence, according to his defense team and according to him, that he killed her or that he was even in the house. And there's no evidence of any DNA or fingerprints that they have that points to him or to anybody else. So there actually are no suspects according to the authorities because they say it's a suicide. So according to the Zahows, however, they believe Adam Shacknai did this. But the problem is it's civil court. And the finding that he was responsible for Rebecca's death was in civil court and not in criminal court. So this has not met the higher threshold for criminality. And that's why it hasn't been a criminal case again, because they don't have evidence that points to anybody. There's no forensic evidence in terms of fingerprints or DNA or somebody's clothing or anything like that, that they can say we have another suspect or someone else was there. So that's one of the main problems with this case in terms of being considered a murder. That's what the sheriff kept saying, is there's all these theories, but there's just no evidence, and we have to think about science. So you think about how this country has been going. We have this huge divide in this country today about people who believe in science. They don't think COVID is a hoax, and they want to get vaccinated. There's a whole other huge portion of the population that still thinks it's a hoax, that doesn't want to get vaccinated, that thinks that the vaccine is going to give you COVID because it has the spike protein in it. They don't even understand what it is. So my point is, this thing about forensic evidence, they have to be able to prove that somebody else was there, and they don't have that. Now, that's not to say that somebody else wasn't there and that the investigation was not complete enough. There are people who believe that, and that maybe they just didn't find the forensic evidence. But at this point, that's why it hasn't gone to criminal court, because they don't have that forensic evidence that points to anybody else.
You really made me stop and think in the book when you talked about her DNA was all over the place, but nobody else was. And if somebody was wiping DNA, they would have wiped her DNA too.
But there's also the main problem is, why wasn't Adam's DNA found? So that shows that the investigation could have been flawed because maybe their collection method wasn't good enough. We know he touched the knife and held the knife to cut the rope. And we know that he touched the rope. And we know that he had his mouth on her mouth, if he's telling the truth. So did they not look in the right place? Because they didn't find it at all. They left the knife in the sun, so it could have been on the knife, but degraded in the sun. These are some of the unanswered questions. The investigators were called to the stand, and they just said, well, you know, it's fragile, and DNA, you think you're going to see it, and it's not there, because if the person just washed their hands or took a shower right beforehand, they may not have, you know, whatever, the oil on their hands to deposit it on that item that we can then find in a test. And he had just taken a shower that morning. We don't know.
That's exactly it. We don't know.
They made a big point of that, though. That's why the House attorney, Keith Greer, was saying this was wiped down, because there's 12 places that his expert said there should have been DNA found where there was no DNA found. So, yeah, there you go. We don't know. There's one good point that I thought someone made, and this was not in court. This was on an Oxygen show, that they used a Q-tip to collect DNA, and they only used one for a whole door. When I heard that, I'm like, oh, wow. So basically, he explained, your swab gets saturated quickly if it's a big surface but a small swab. So why not use more than one swab? If somebody's touching different parts of the door, maybe if you used two Q-tips or five Q-tips, maybe you would have found another source of DNA. Do you see what I mean? He said the collection methods were flawed as well because they did things like that. I learned a lot from investigating this case.
This is my opinion only. I don't think there's enough evidence that Rebecca committed suicide.
Uh-huh.
But the police conclusion was that she was grief-stricken because of Max's accident and his right. death. But at the time, he was still alive.
Right.
And her history shows she really wouldn't have picked such a public way to kill herself.
Right. I'm not taking a position either way in terms of whether this was a suicide or a murder. Honestly, I went back and forth many times during my investigation of this case. But I do think there is evidence that she committed suicide. I also think there is evidence, or at least enough unanswered questions, that cannot be explained by suicide, that it needs more investigation. And there's a lot of things that just don't make sense if it's a suicide, that it looks more like a murder. So I can see both sides of this. I just want to get that on the record. But I do believe that there is evidence that she committed suicide, although I can't say for sure that she did, and I can't say for sure that she was murdered. So she was a troubled person, though, and I think her family did not know her as well as they think that they did. I did 8 lengthy interviews with Jonah Shackney, her boyfriend, and he had not talked to anybody else except a real brief interview with 2020. He lived with her and was her boyfriend for over 2 years. He didn't really know her as well as he thought he did either. It turns out that she was telling different stories to everybody. She was a troubled person. My investigation, I interviewed one of her old boyfriends, Michael Berger, who she was with while she was married. She told him all kinds of stories, that she was getting divorced, that she was separated from her husband, that she wanted to be with him and not with her husband. And then one day she disappears, and then she calls him and she's crying, and she says she's, over the course of a couple days, she keeps calling and saying, I can't see you anymore, but I've been taken, and they've got me blindfolded, and they're driving me around in this car, blah, 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 you know. And then she comes back, and then she disappears again, and he never sees her after that, and she's off in Oregon. And it turns out she's back with her husband, but she never tells Michael that. So she has a history of telling people different stories. She's not who she really appears to be, and she just seemed like a really troubled person that was trying to please people and didn't want to hurt people and couldn't make decisions. She just seemed sad to me, and I don't think her family really saw her that way. They saw her as always happy and exercising and positive. There were these notes left on her phone that she wrote that showed us how angry she was at Jonah, how she didn't feel that he had supported her. They were having a lot of problems because his teenage kids were being rude to her, disrespectful to her, and he wasn't sticking up for her. That's how she felt. And she was angry about it. My husband committed suicide. He hung himself, and I know what he was like in the days before. I know that because he was diagnosed and I was with him. Rebecca had never been diagnosed with any mental health issues. She showed them a side of her that Jonah didn't see. She showed a different side of her to Jonah than she did to her family. So I think she presented herself differently to different people. So I do think there is some evidence. The question is, though, why would she do it like this, right? If it's suicide like this, that's the thing. If he murdered her, why would they call so much attention to themselves? Why would they murder her in this way? So that's what's always baffled me. Either way, it still doesn't make sense. That's why it's such a crazy case.
The one piece of evidence I can't get it out of my head is the fact that she put the rope over top of her hair. I have long hair. It's a knee-jerk thing. You pull your hair out of whatever thing that gives me pause.
And why would she be naked? I mean, she was proud of her body, according to Jonah. She was always showing off her body, whatever she wore, tight clothes, midriff showing. She's very athletic. She was very obsessed with her body and how she looked. Let's put it this way. I think there are things that people aren't admitting to. Why would she be tied up like that? Suicide or murder? Why would she be tied up like that? Yeah. So we don't know. But either somebody did that to her for a reason, or she did it to herself for a reason. Those were pretty intricate knots. The sheriff's department says they weren't. The defense team was trying to say it wasn't. But even Adam said, I couldn't tie a knot like that. I don't know what kind of knot that was. So he thinks it was shibari, which is this Japanese erotic self-tying sexual thing. How would she know how much rope would get her that far off the ground? I mean, there are just all these questions that I have that, you know, yes, there's evidence of suicide, but there's also a lot of unanswered questions.
And her center of gravity, how would she have thrown herself off the balcony?
Right. And the sheriff's department says there are these clear prints on the balcony. No, other people say, no, they're not clear. And in fact, it seems like there's only a toe. How are you going to get all your weight to throw yourself over that balcony with just being on your toe, on one toe? So I mean, there's a lot of reasons why suicide doesn't make sense as well. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm saying it was a suicide. I'm not. Yeah. I'm saying there's evidence showing both.
Unexplained death.
I think it would have been great if they did more investigation and if they had asked other questions that they didn't ask.
Another part that makes you have to stop and think is the door. You know, she's only 5'3", but the note was much higher. I know it's paint, so it's not necessarily what your handwriting would look at, but did they ever look at that as far as could it match how she would have written?
There's a lot of questions in this one. So there was a message on the door. She saved him. Can you save her? Okay. It was in two separate lines. It was all capital letters. According to the sheriff's handwriting person, he says, oh, I couldn't even do a comparison because number one, it's painted, not written. So it's a paintbrush, not someone holding a pen on a piece of paper. And so there's no way to do a comparison because that's just not scientific. So they just didn't even try. That's what the guy basically said on the stand. So the Zahal family had a guy who the defense team spent like an entire day with the jury not present, trying to keep him out of the courtroom from testifying. He basically said he looked at signatures and whatever writing he could get. And he thought it was more likely that Adam wrote it than Rebecca, but it was very couched. He couldn't say for sure. More likely. And that is the standard in a civil court. Okay. So it's like 51% pointing to one person versus 49. You could say it's more likely that Adam did it than Rebecca. He didn't give us any numbers, but that's the standard. In criminal court, it's a much higher standard and it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's the same for the jury. Anyway, he basically said he looked at the A's and he looked at the M's and he thought that those letters were more like Adam's than Rebecca because Adam signs his name using capital letters. He prints his signature in capital letters, which I thought was an odd coincidence.
It's just a weird, weird case.
But you said the height thing. Okay, so according to the defense's expert, it was too high for Rebecca to do that comfortably. However, in the courtroom, the defense attorney tried to call one of his employees to come and do a demonstration, and the judge yelled at him, and you can't do that. You know, it's not a witness. You can't have somebody come and do that. Months later, after the verdict came in, finding Adam responsible, the sheriff did a review because he was in the middle of a re-election campaign. And his opponent said, if I were elected sheriff, I would reopen this as a criminal case. Because of that, the sheriff said, okay, we'll do a review of our investigation. So they didn't interview anybody or anybody new. They didn't really do much, frankly, but they supposedly went back and read through the trial transcripts and listened for whatever theories were presented, but they ended up 9 months later sticking to the exact same position they had. But during the press conference, which I was told I could come to, and then I was told I couldn't come to because I had no press pass, which I thought was absurd. But anyway, during the news conference, one of the detectives basically said that he didn't think that it was too high, somebody that height to write it. So there you go. You know, when it's sitting on the ground, it's one thing, and it's actually in the frame, it's a little higher. It's mounted on the actual door frame in the hinges, and it goes up a little higher. It's a question of whether you're just standing the door on the floor and somebody tries to write on it, or who knows. According to the Zahals, you have to be somewhere between, I think it was 5'10" and 6 feet, the person who would write that comfortably, and Adam is 5'11", and Rebecca's 5'4", I think.
We could talk to you about this case all day. I think we need to learn a little bit about you. Okay. We're going to switch gears here.
Okay. Can you tell us about your memoir, Secret Lives and Shoelaces?
Secrets, Lies, and Shoelaces. I wrote that over a 19-year period. It took me a long time because it was very difficult to write. It was about my marriage, my relationship with my late husband who hung himself in a motel room in Mexico. My editor at Kensington Citadel Press, which is the publisher of this book, I've done 6 books before this one with the same publisher. I've never done this before, but she wanted me to basically put myself into this story because I have this unique perspective because my husband did commit suicide by hanging, and we know for sure that he did that. There was no question. And in fact, I was expecting it. I looked at this case through the lens of my own personal experience and my own personal knowledge of what somebody acts like and behaves like, says and does before they hang themselves. Rebecca did show some troubling signs. She shoplifted early on before she met Jonah. She was arrested and she did a plea bargain. And she lied to people. She lied to her family. She lied to Jonah. She lied to her ex-husband. She lied to her ex-boyfriend. So she had a number of, and so did my husband. Very coincidentally, my husband also was arrested for shoplifting while he was in Phoenix, and they went through the very same diversion program. Now, my husband was an alcoholic, and he was in a blackout, and he was the chief investment officer for the county pension fund here in San Diego. Alcoholics are sick people. Now, Rebecca has no history of addiction, but my point is that I saw some parallels in her past and in his past. Her family doesn't think that she ever had any mental illness, but I'm just going based on some of the behaviors. She never talked about suicide, though. She never threatened to commit suicide. My husband did multiple times. So, I mean, they're not the same person. They're not the same situation, but I did see some similarities. My husband was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder by our marriage counselor, who told me and did not tell him, which was very awkward. My memoir basically just goes into our whole relationship and what it was like. And I am just basically calling attention to that because I was finally able to finish writing it after sitting through the Rebecca Zahow trial. I was able to kind of get some closure, I think, for myself to be able to write about that because I've been trying and trying. I published that myself. If anybody wants more background on my story and what my experience was, then people can read that. But I have kind of a super condensed version of, you know, what I wove into Death on Ocean Boulevard so that people know that I have that experience. And I do put myself into the story in different places because I'm interviewing Adam, for example. There's a whole couple scenes there. I've had a really positive response from most people who've read this book. I mean, a really positive response who've reviewed it early. And I've only had a couple people that I've read so far, readers, who didn't like the fact that I put myself in. But my editor and I both thought that because of my experience that people should know that's where I'm coming from and I have this unique perspective.
Exactly. And actually, I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Sometimes you wonder where people get their information from and are they just guessing?
Right.
But you have first
up that path.
Yeah.
You wanted to know also about is something else I'm working on?
Whatever it is, I'm definitely going to read it.
Well, okay, so I'm writing a novel. I have the one novel that's out. It's called Naked Addiction. My themes, if you can't tell, mental illness and addiction, those are themes in some of the different cases that I pick. And suicide, those are really, you know, light topics. I'm writing a sequel. It's got the same detective in it. It basically pulls from my experience in covering a lot of these cases. Staged suicides, staged murders, drugs, sex. That's a lot of what I write about. Now that I have all this information and I have all this experience and knowledge about how homicide cases are investigated and how many times there really are staged scenes. The Rebecca Zahow case is either a staged homicide or it's a staged suicide, but either way, it was staged. I think that's what people pretty much seem to agree on, no matter what side of it you're on. So anyway, my novel that I'm working on, I'm pulling from all these different cases that I've written about, including this one. It should be fun. It's about the mysterious death of older man and this younger woman who turn out to be father and daughter. There's obviously something very strange about the scene. A lot of things don't make sense. They say it's a suspicious death, just like the Rebecca Zahow one. Always investigate that as it's a homicide just so they don't miss anything. It's called Dopamine Fix, F-I-X, like a fix, like, you know, I got to get my fix. Dopamine is something that's always fascinated me. But, you know, when you can't stop looking at your phone and you're addicted to your phone and you want to see if you got an email, you want to check on Facebook to see if somebody's responded to something you just posted, your brain releases dopamine. It makes you do that. When you're in a brand new relationship and you're all infatuated and you're very attracted to that person, that's dopamine. Mm-hmm. So dopamine is a powerful neurotransmitter and it's a reward-seeking transmitter. That's what that's about. It's this fun book. It's got a biotech aspect to it, police detective, and then there's an investigative reporter. So there's romantic tension and it's a fun book. All the good stuff. Yeah.
When will that come out?
Well, I'm working on it right now. I'm supposed to have it done this year with Wild Blue Press, but I'm still working on it. Good. So I don't have a specific date yet, but it should be later this year.
I really appreciate you writing about these topics because I think there's very few families that haven't been touched by addiction. Our family has the trifecta. We've been touched by suicide, we've been touched by addiction, and we've been touched by mental illness.
You're right. I think those are themes that a lot of people can relate to. At least someone in their family has had one or more of those issues. Right. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate you saying that.
Caitlin, we loved this book. I could not put it down.
Awesome.
And our heart goes out to you for what you've had to experience in your life. You just keep writing these wonderful books and you've got 3 new fans.
Oh, thank you. That's so nice to hear. Thank you so much. And thank you for having me on your show.
You enjoy the rest of your day. Because you've got a lot more of it than we do. We're in Maryland, so.
I'm going to be taking pictures of my partner. I'm helping him release his first record album. I'm the photographer. I'm doing his website, and that's a whole lot of fun, too. So that's what I'll be doing.
Cool.
Yeah. We sing together, too. It's fun.
Oh, wow. Cool. All right, Caitlin. Well, we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
This episode ran a little long, but we thought it was an important one to include everything. And we thank Caitlin very much for joining us. We highly recommend this book. Be sure and pick it up. Well, that brings us to the end of another episode. Thank you for listening. We hope you join us next week. We will have one more recast after this episode, and then we'll be back with some interesting and exciting new episodes. Thanks, and see you soon. And remember,
life would be boring without a little mystery. Bye.